Okay, here we are again for one last time. this is not the last time. Actually, I'm giving a talk tomorrow night. so this is an extra seminar to try and see whether we can get to spiritual rebirth rather than finish with spiritual death, which didn't feel quite. No, we've not got so much time for Reba. And that's how it should be. Let's really concentrate on the death of Reba. Okay. One of the things I've been at sort of pains to point out is that Buddhism isn't a theory. It's not something that the Buddha thought up. He's not a philosopher. He's not a metaphysician. He was quite clearly a very, very deep thinker. But he wasn't trying to come up with a metaphysical theory for everything. He wasn't like a kind of ancient Indian Kant or Schopenhauer. He was not trying to find a system. Everything that appears like theory is really observation. So even Pratitya Samuppada, some people say the only doctrine of Buddhism, that's the one doctrine and the rest is method, even that doctrine is an observation, not a theory. Yeah? So it's how the Buddha saw life. It's not a theory that he dreamt up to think about life and then to see life through. It's as close as he could get conceptually say, this is how I see things. It's very important to remember that it's an observation of life, in other words, not a theory about life. That Buddhism arises, the Dharma arises, from a deep seeing into life itself. It doesn't arise from a thinking about it and then trying to see life through that net of thought. I've come to think that you could think of the whole of Buddhism as being merely to do with observation, developing your powers to observe. So first of all, you observe that much of your life is spent in this kind of whirligig of the mind, in this endlessly proliferating thought. Not really thought, but endlessly proliferating chatter. And as you observe that, you think, well, that can't be right. I don't want to spend my life somewhere else. This is me. I don't want to spend my life away from life. So you start to discover that if you pay attention to your body, if you observe the feelings of your body, that quietens down your mind and makes you feel more integrated. And then you start to observe that your actions have consequences. That if you're in a bad mood, it really does feel as if the sun doesn't shine and people frown at you. Whereas if you're in a good mood, it starts to feel like people are very friendly to you and the sun shines. That your mood and your experience of the world kind of co-arise. I had this lovely experience just yesterday, very simply, just feeling this is good. This is good, this life, this is good. And when you see life in that way, this is good. Everything seems to shine more, doesn't it? So you just observe, I'd like to feel that more often. And you start to observe, actually, when I'm generous, the world seems to expand, the universe seems to expand. When I'm mean, the universe seems to contract. So how about I do the first but not the second? You get this in the lovely story of the Buddha where he said, when I was young, I realized there were two kinds of thoughts. Thoughts that led me into negative mental states and thoughts that led me into positive states. So I thought, why don't I abandon the first and just practice the second? It's very, very simple. It's just to do with observing, if you see what I mean. And it literally is to do with observing the world around you. So recently, when I was giving this seminar, we have a team setting up the class. We had about 100 people at the seminar sometimes. It's very, very big. one of the biggest events we've had for a while. And we have a team that clears up afterwards. And they're all given jobs, who's really washing up the cups and so on. And we have two sofas and they have these pillows on them. And as they're sat on, they get sort of squeezed into the corners of the sofas. You know what happens to pillows. You didn't expect me to talk about this, did you? You're thinking, where are we going with this? Where can he be going? Very profound. There's no one's job to do anything about them. I mean, and mostly they're left like that. And then somebody on the team, I noticed, was getting the cushions and fluffing them back up again and putting them back. It really struck me that it was just to do with observation. He'd just seen something that needed doing and done it. It hadn't been his job to do it. It hadn't been something he was supposed to do. He'd just seen what needed to be done and just done it. Yeah. Really, that action, followed all the way through, becomes enlightenment. You just see what needs to be done and you just do it. Without thinking, hang on, it's not my job, da da da. You just see, and when you see properly, you act. And that's true for those cushions squeezed into the sofa. And it's also true for old age, sickness, and death. When you see it properly, you act. When you see the vision of the Dharma properly, you act. If you aren't acting, you aren't seeing. Most people on the team just didn't see those cushions, literally, you see what I mean? They didn't show up to them. And this is why responsibility is central to spiritual life, because as soon as you see, you have a responsibility, don't you? As soon as you see that something needs doing, that responsibility appears to you. And this is true for us, and it's true for the Buddha. So after enlightenment, he opens his eyes, as it were, and sees a world of suffering. And then he has to act. As soon as you see a world of suffering, you have to act. If you don't act, you haven't seen it. Whatever you say about it, you haven't seen it. Yeah? So you could think of whole of spiritual life as just to do with observation. You just observe. And eventually you observe that all things arise in dependence and conditions. When you look at your most objective and your most pure and your most positive, you just see all things arise in dependence on conditions. There's no me, there's no you, there's no world, there's no self, there's no in, there's no out. There's just all things arising on dependence on conditions, all things ceasing in dependence on conditions. That's all there is. And it's an observation. You just see it. It's a vision of reality. And it's a direct seeing, unmediated by words. So you see what I mean? You can think of the whole of spiritual life as simply to do with your capacity to observe. Some people are very observant. Some people are curiously unobservant about their own behaviour, about the world around them, about the consequences of their actions. I think sometimes some people literally can't see those things for various reasons. Where was I? I've distracted myself. I got so keen on that particular way of that line of thought that I've forgotten why I was saying it. Why was I saying it?
Speaking of a witch being observant of your own.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I got so so absorbed in the notion of observation, I stopped observing where I was. Yes, speaking of which, exactly. Anyway, never mind, I can't remember. It might come back to me. Oh, well, there you go. Let's get back to the Buddha's enlightenment. I can't remember. Where was I saying? I can't remember at all.
From the beginning again.
Okay, cut. Can we do that right from the beginning again?
said his spiritual life is about.
Yes, I'll start from there. So one thing that the Buddhist, that's where I started. I started with, right early on I was saying that Buddhism isn't a theory. At last I found it. Buddhism isn't a theory, isn't it? Remember? It's an observation. That's why we went on that great long trajectory on observation. It's not a theory, it's an observation. And I said that it's something the Buddha sees. And he said later on, I only teach suffering and the end of suffering. Yeah. That's one of the things I mentioned earlier. I only teach suffering and the end of suffering. I'm not interested in metaphysics. I'm not interested in speculation. I'm not interested in mental gymnastics. I'm interested in suffering and the end of suffering. But this is, in our contemporary world, only too easy to misconstrue. This was prompted by another question. Please say. It's only too easy to misconstrue. Because you think, oh, well, that sounds right, doesn't it? I only teach suffering and the end of suffering. So whatever helps the end of suffering is Buddhism. And that's sort of true. In fact, that's very true up to a point. But you see that there's an inherent danger in that, that we think that Buddhism is simply to do with the absence of suffering. So you could strictly say that what you get in enlightenment is the absence of nisprapunctia, no prapunctia. And you could say what you're left with is the absence of greed, hatred and delusion. Strictly speaking, you could say that. You know what I mean? In fact, the early Pali sources are almost violently negative in the sense that they say no, 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 no. So the Buddha was teaching in a universe, in a eternalist environment, where the idea of continuance, the idea of some kind of Godhead, the idea of arising, was the strongest atmosphere around him. The assumption was always that there was some kind of eternal essence, that there was some kind of eternalism. So the Buddha's teaching is, from our own point of view, looks incredibly negative. He keeps just saying, no, it's not like that. Don't get me to say you what it is like, because you'll only get it wrong. That's what the Buddha would say. Never mind all that. It's not like that. You know what I mean? But to our modern world, I don't think the Buddha would teach like this at all. The environment that we're in is almost entirely the opposite. It's almost entirely nihilistic rather than eternalistic. We're actually in a very odd way, weird place, because probably eternalism is more natural to human beings, because your innate sense of yourself is that somehow you go on forever. Other things around you change, but you go on forever. That's your innate sense. But we've got that complicated and overlaid by a sense that when you die, that's just the end. That there's nothing, there's nihilism here. So our worldview is much more complicated. It's very strongly nihilistic. So that we can think that the end of suffering just means the removal of those things, but I'm just pretty much myself as I am. Does this mean? I don't have any greed, I don't have any hatred, I don't have any ignorance. Not that we really know what ignorance means, but never mind. I don't have those things. So I'm kind of just me without those things. Do you see what I mean? So that could reduce the whole of Buddhism to merely me being in a good state. And this is one of the dangers of the new interest in mindfulness, international interest in mindfulness, which is, you know, very, very interesting, because it offers Buddhism an opportunity unparalleled probably in Buddhist history, where an aspect of Buddhist teaching is becoming mainstream. There are huge opportunities in that, and there are opportunities that we as Buddhists need to be stepping into, I think. But you see, if you're not careful, you reduce everything to a well-being practice, to a being okay practice, One day I will hear somebody say to me, yes, the Buddha was all right, but he didn't have a clinical background. I don't think he did a PhD in psychology. It's just around the corner in my sense. So the analogy I was using, we were talking together, is if you were to go to a concert and in that marvellous moment that very, so rarely happens, you just slipped into the music entirely and felt the music take you into another world. I mean, I remember this once very, very strongly. I was travelling through somewhere, Holland, I think, and listening to my Sony Walkman. I was only quite young. I was at art school. And I'd just discovered Requiem. So I had a big thing about Requiems for a long time. And I listened to one Requiem after another. And I was listening to Fauré's Requiem, the French composer. And I was lying on my bunk bed in this youth hostel listening to Fauré's Requiem, slightly sort of tired after a journey. And there's one point in Fauré's Requiem where there's this lovely chorus. It's a very sweet Requiem. I don't know whether you know it. It's the most comforting of Requiems. It's the opposite of the first part of Mozart's Requiem, which is all hell, really. Or of Verdi's Requiem, which is secular, really. Or Britain's Requiem, which is... there's so many, they're wonderful. And there's this part in it where you get this lovely chorus. And this chorus, I think it's mainly sopranos or even trebles. And it's very, very quiet and comforting. And it sort of slows down at the end of it. And then this tenor voice appears out of the middle of it, like the stamen appearing in the middle of a flower. And it's just one note. The first line of the song is one repeated note. And it just appears out of... It's as if this chorus sort of gradually, slowly closes. And as it closes, this... one line of sound arises out of it, and as I listened to it, my whole body sort of, you know, that experience of a complete sort of takeoff, as it were. I felt this intense exhilaration that made you want to sob and laugh at the same time. Is this incredible sense of being taken quite out of the world, if you see what I mean. And if you were to be having an experience like that, and someone said, oh, that's you not suffering at the moment, is that how you'd like to describe that? That was me not suffering. You would think that was an inadequate description of the experience, wouldn't you? You would say, well, sort of. You could say that. You could sort of technically say that. But it really doesn't tell you anything about the nature of the experience at all. Do you see what I mean? Or when you're rapturously involved in the landscape, if you get that magic sometimes, so often the landscape stays out there, but sometimes when you've meditated particularly a lot and your mind is cleaner and purer, the landscape steps towards you, doesn't it? I don't know whether you notice that. Sometimes after meditation, if you're quiet enough, all you need to do is go and sit outside, and it's all as if all the trees turn towards you and start to... be subjects themselves rather than objects to your subject. They seem to be, you start to experience them as a subject as well. So you experience life as being an intersubjectivity rather than a subject-object relationship. If you again said to that about that experience, oh, it's just that I'm not suffering anymore, you'd only be able to say it's merely technically correct, wouldn't you? So to think of the Dharma, to think of the Buddha as being merely someone that doesn't suffer in that way, do you see what I mean? It doesn't actually say anything about him, actually. It says nothing important about that experience. And I think this is something that we don't draw out enough. This is why Sangharakshita Bhante said that you needed a transcendental object. It's a slightly technical sounding thing, where do you buy them? And is the shop still open? I went to buy my transcendental object. Can you get them on Amazon? But a transcendental object is something that stands for the new arising that happens when self dies. Does it mean? That's what the bodhisattva figures are. They're transcendental objects in that sense. They embody, they picture how it feels like to have been living without greed, hatred and delusion, to have seen through self, to have allowed self to die. If one wants to describe it, you'd have to say something like, it's as if there was a young prince who was sitting on a blue lotus throne in the middle of vast space. And this young prince was the colour of a lion's eye. And this young prince had a face like the sun. And he carried a sword. And he held a book to his heart. And it was the most beautiful face I'd ever seen, like the face of glory. You'd have to say, it's like that. Do you see what I mean? You wouldn't say, oh yes, it's, I noticed I wasn't suffering anymore. So do you see that you need a transcendental object to give you any taste of the experience of what is spiritual rebirth? Yeah. So when the Buddha achieved enlightenment, you have to, you have to imagine him, don't you, in a way. It occurred to me this morning. You have to imagine him opening his eyes after the enlightenment. That moment of him opening his eyes. There's no thing about it in the book, but in a way that would be the moment, wouldn't it, when he opens his eyes. In that time when he opens his eyes, that's a whole new species opening their eyes to the world. You know what I mean? There's a wonder, I don't know whether you know Wagner's Ring Cycle, the tetralogy, in Siegfried, the fourth of the operas. Siegfried goes and discovers Brunhilde, who's a god and who's, she's been banished because she disobeyed her father. It's a very interesting metaphor. Put on a rock, surrounded by flame, and the only person who can wake her, they have to walk through a wall of flame to get to her. And there's this moment when she opens her eyes, and the music, there's just this one chord, and in the score it says, Brunhilde opens her eyes. And this chord is the sound of Brunhilde opening her eyes. And if you're into the music, this is this sudden appearance of glory. You know, it's really quite incredible. This, and she just then sings to the sun. She sings this incredible kind of paean to the sun. Because she opens her eyes for the first time in the world, if you see what I mean. So the Buddha opening his eyes might have been something like that, that suddenly there was a new world, because as soon as there's a new self, there's a new world. It's not that it's the same world anymore, there's a new world, a world seen without ignorance, greed, hatred. But we can't imagine that world, if you see what I mean. And later sutras, I think, are trying to tell you what it's like. So there's a sutra in there, I can't remember which one it is, where a Mahayana sutra, where somebody asks the Buddha, what does the world look like for you? And he touches the earth and transforms the world into a Buddha field. And in an Indian psychology, that meant it was flat, because it was a pain going up and down hills, having to carry things. Hills aren't featured in Indian sort of legend because they just make hard work. So you create something like Holland. And it's made of lapis lazuli, and all the trees are made of jewels. They're jewel trees, aren't they? And really, I think it's just saying, it looks like that. The world, I mean, when you're in even a slightly more meditative state, the trees look like jewel trees, don't they? In what sense are they not jewel trees? They're only not jewel trees because we don't see them like that. We see them as dead matter, which is this terrible end point that we've got to. We've said that the world is dead and that we're the living language animal in this dead world. So you have to imagine the Buddha opening his eyes to this world. And seeing that everything is a jewel. He's just sitting in this jeweled world, which is the reflection of his mind. I wanted to draw out two little contrasting little stories from those very, very early moments. But what first is that the first thing he does, after he sat, must have sat there for ages, absorbing the experience, the first thing he does is he stands up, he walks away, and he just looks at the tree. He just looks at the tree that he's been sitting under and gained enlightenment. According to the Mahayana Sutra, he looks at it for 7 days. But again, all these things could be metaphors. Say it's as if he looked at it for 7 days. He just stood and looked at it, and what he felt was overwhelming gratitude for this tree. Very interesting thing, isn't it, that what you get, the first thing, is you get gratitude. The arising of maha gratitude, this great feeling of fortune. And I think this is, again, symptomatic of any moment where we make any kind of breakthrough. It's signified by a feeling of great gratitude. The tiny breakthroughs I've had, and I haven't as many as I'd like, I experience myself as having been, before that moment, absurdly good fortuned, in the receipt of such great good fortune. And when I have that moment of breakthrough, I feel that good fortune. Oh, good heavens, I've been so lucky, I've been given so much, I'm so fortunate. I'm the fortunate one. I remember the first time I ordained somebody walking back from the stupa. And, I was really, really struck, how has this happened to me? I'm just a boy from a small town in Warwickshire in England. Very little town, rather small-minded town. How did I get to be in this position where I'm handing on the Dharma? However did that happen? I've been so fortunate. I didn't realise how fortunate I had. I've been sitting on a great casket of jewels. So any time that there's any kind of breakthrough, there is this sense of almost absurd good fortune, if you know what I mean. And I think you see that all the way up to the enlightenment, so that the Buddha just gazes at the tree. He gazes at the tree. And then another little story I wanted to draw out is one of the first people that met the Buddha. There's different stories about who was first, but one of the first people who met the Buddha was a Brahmin. And a Brahmin came up to him and said, there's a tendency in ancient India to ask tricky questions. And he just said, "Oh, you look fairly wise. How do you get to be wise?" And the Buddha said, "You're not born wise. It's just to do with you. It's nothing to do with your social status. In other words, it's nothing to do with being a Brahmin. It's nothing to do with caste. It's nothing to do with hereditary. It's just to do with the individual man or woman." Wisdom comes from the individual man or woman. It doesn't come through social status, it doesn't come through caste status, it doesn't come through hereditary. Now what's striking about that is, what he's doing effectively, he's immediately refusing the world. You have to remember that ancient India is, and still is, thick with caste. It's its primary socio-political form is caste. Cultural, socio-political form, that there are people at the top who are special spiritual people, and there are people at the bottom who can't even be touched. Even worse than them, there are people at the bottom whose shadow can't even, your shadow can't even touch them, because that would pollute you. That kind of world vision of hierarchy in that genetic, that sort of given sense, is absolutely central to the Indian mind. And the first thing the Buddha says is that saying that is wrong. So it's important to remember this, because the Buddha is saying the world is wrong. It's one of the first things he says, that no, it's not like that. So any genuine follower of the Buddha should be following this as well. It's saying we're trying to discover the Dharma, and so much of life in any time is a-dharma, anti-dharma. Of course, it's not so much the caste system for us, obviously not, but our obsessive materialism, our rampant consumerism, our media-soaked environment, our terrible creation of a split world with the haves and the have-nots. The Buddha would say that that's not right, straight away. One of the first things he says, he didn't say all that, by the way, let me tell you about enlightenment. He just says, it's nothing to do with how you set it up, no. So you see the Buddha immediately, he has this incredible capacity to fly in the face of convention. The Buddha, for some people, was seen as a kind of menace, a social menace. Not a nice person at all. And the Buddha at times, just to make it clear, could be really quite terrifying. There's a sutra where, again, there's a Brahmin, they're a bit cheeky Brahmin, they're rather full of themselves. A Brahmin is famous for being able to argue with people philosophically and metaphysically and make them tremble and shake, various things. First, tremble and sweat. Yeah. So he goes to see the Buddha and involves himself in an argument with the Buddha. So the Buddha starts to discuss with him. And every move this man makes to trick him, the Buddha's a bit quicker. Until eventually, the philosophical argument has got to us, and this is public, I think, because this guy was trying to humiliate the Buddha. And at the end, of course, this Brahmin is shaking and trembling and sweating because he feels, presumably, such a fool. And the Buddha doesn't leave it at that. He says, okay, so you came to talk to me, and you came to talk to me because you're famous for getting people to argue with people and making them tremble and sweat and shake. So who is trembling and sweating and shaking now? Am I trembling or are you trembling? Am I sweating or are you sweating? So in other words, he really rubs it in. He doesn't just leave it at that. He really rubs it in. You know, to be around that would have been quite, quite terrifying. I want you to say that because we must get away from this idea of the Buddha as a kind of Jesus-like figure almost. He's quite capable of flying in the face of convention. So there we go, we've got the Buddha, he's woken up to the world is now transformed. He has this experience of gratitude to the Bodhi tree, and he's already flying in the face of convention. He's already saying that my vision absolutely does not agree with yours. It's opposed to yours, effectively. So what I want to do now is just say something about... So, what spiritual rebirth is trying to get at is it's trying to say what arises when self dies. Going back to what I said at the start, you see how you can't just talk about it in terms of spiritual death. You can't just talk about it in the terms of the end of suffering. You need a transcendental object, otherwise, just as that experience with landscape or with music, your description beggars the experience. Any positive state of mind cannot be explained just in terms of absence of suffering. So spiritual rebirth is trying to explore what the contents of that experience is. If you had to talk theistically, you'd say the contents of that experience are a bit like, and be very careful with this, folks, are a bit like what other traditions would think of as God. It's at that kind of level, if you see what I mean. Other traditions have misseen that level, but it's analogous with God. It's like the experience of grace. It's like the experience of... Well, it is the experience of transcending the world, being in the world, but being not being of the world. It's a wholly new thing. You need, and you're forced into images for it. You're forced into stories. And you can see why all the bodhisattvas arise out of that need to try to show you actually what the goal feels like, not merely give you a technical, sort of technically correct, yes, it's the absence of greed, hatred and delusion. For us, that isn't good enough. The reason the Buddha was probably so reticent to give it much content is because he was living in this eternalist world where people were only too keen to reify those experiences into God, or gods, if you see what I mean. So he's just saying, it's not like that, it's not that. We're rather too keen to reduce things into me, reduce things into me in a good state, me in a good mood, which actually destroys Buddhism, really. The goal transcends the path. It's not as if the path leads to the goal, and what you get is, it's not like going to a shop, you know, you don't just walk there and you've got there. The goal transcends the path, so much so that people who experience anything like the goal feel they've got much more than they bargained for. They feel that the result of the practice is far greater than anything they've actually done to get it, if you see what I mean. That's quite typical of people who have genuine spiritual experiences, is it feels like they've done this bit, and then it's not that much, but they've gained all of this, much, much more than they deserve, if you see what I mean. Again, it's this sense of almost gratuitous good fortune, if you see what I mean. That's the emotional tenor of it, I think. And that's what spiritual rebirth means, this sense of almost gratuitous good fortune. That there is this constant arising of Dharma Nirma processes, to use that technical word again. There's just a wind of the Dharma blowing through us. There's just pure activity. So what you get in the Buddha is volition and action, but it's not egoistic volition. It's not self-willed, because there's no self to will. We can't imagine that. But there's just pure responsiveness. So it's said, for instance, that the Buddha had no view. In other words, any time he came into a meeting with someone, he had no presuppositions about them, no prejudice about them, no view about them. And he would just respond completely to what he observed, without, as it were, any thought, without any mental work. He just responded immediately to that capacity to see and respond was just all that was left. It's as if this observation goes right through to the end, where all there is observation and what arises naturally from that. There's no person in which it arises. You know what I mean? There's suffering, and then out of suffering arises naturally compassion. There's no one being compassionate. The Buddha isn't compassionate. He's just being himself. It's us that experience the Buddha as compassionate, if you mean. Him being himself, we experience as being compassionate. But he's not being compassionate. He's not being wise. He's not being any of those things. He's just being himself, as it were. So this is what spiritual rebirth is really about. So let me try and finish by, let's say, trying to look at how we can practically cultivate it. So I can talk about that in two ways, I think, and give us the last quarter now. So just like spiritual death, any practice of spiritual rebirth is analogous. It's not like, do you see how that's different to integration of positive emotion? You can literally practice those two things. Every time you become aware of your body, you are cultivating integration. Every time you are generous, you are cultivating positive emotion. When you practice spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, they're practices only by analogy. They're valuable and essential, but let's not mix it up as if it's the same kind of practice. just what I mean. So it's not that you can practice spiritual rebirth, really, strictly. Only by analogy can you practice it. So the first analogy I want to use is goes back to what I've been saying about community, which I've been wanting to emphasize more and more. Something in a community, sometimes amongst us, when we're all genuinely focused on the Dharma, when we're meditating together, living together, like we are on this retreat, sometimes something appears amongst us which is more than us, that's more than the sum of our parts, if you see what I mean. It's quite, you can perceive it, it's shared, it's actually almost physical, isn't it? I can tell when I'm talking, when I've found the Dharma in talking, because you found it. I can feel you finding it sometimes. And when you find it, I find it. Or when you find it, I think I become aware that I've found it. if you mean. It's not mine, it's just that I've discovered it in talking to you. And my discovering of it is as much to do with you as it is to do with me. If you are interested in me, if you are not particularly interested in what I have to say, I can't find it. If you're a bunch of sixth formers doing Buddhist studies and were just waiting for the end of class, I could say things, but I couldn't find it. I couldn't get that atmosphere. Do you see what I mean? Which is different to what I say, is different to what I can tell you that Subhuti says or Bhante says or what I see that the Buddha said. It's a kind of atmosphere, isn't it? Sometimes the words touch on it. Sometimes together we all seem to go a bit deeper. It's happened, hasn't it, some of these days between us. Something goes a bit deeper, we're touched by something. And sometimes it's so palpable I can almost sit into it, I can relax into it, you know what I mean? I felt that a bit yesterday when I was leading the meditation mid-morning. There was an atmosphere in the room where I could just talk into it, and all I needed to do was let the atmosphere of the room talk, if you see what I mean. I happened to be the one at the front talking it, if you see what I mean. But another day you'll be at the front talking it, and I'll be sitting in the room, open to it, hopefully. Do you see what I mean? It only happens to be me in this place just now. Next time it'll be very Bodhi, next time it'll be Vajrayana. You know, it'll just move, and next time it'll be one of you. What's important is this atmosphere that arises between us. And you see how it's not an idea, it's not a theory, it's something you can directly experience, isn't it? So much so that you can almost tell that everybody else is experiencing it. There's that moment, for instance, on retreats where someone says, that was a good puja last night. You've been doing pujas all week, and suddenly you say, that was a good puja last night. In other words, that was a puja last night. The other ones were kind of, I don't know what they were, kind of going through the motions. Well, let's just say going through the motions. As one does, in whatever language you mumble in. I've been mumbling in cod Swedish. I'm doing an impersonation of what I'm hearing. But sometimes you sense, don't you, that now we're doing a puja. And you could almost say it was a good puja last night, wasn't it? Because you know everybody was doing a puja. Something arose between you which transcended you and which you feel yourself to be in deep unity with other people. And in that unity, a spirit, as it were, arises. Out of that unity arises a sort of spirit, which can become so strong as to be actually palpable, I think. You can see why in some traditions you didn't want to say the devas have arrived. Traditionally that's what happens, is when devas are attracted by positive mental states, So they tend to hang around pujas, apparently. But you can see what that metaphor is. There's a moment in a puja where you feel, oh, the devas have arrived. Or there's a moment where, in a seminar, where the devas come into the room because there's something so positive in the room, just to me. And you can just feel it. It's quite straightforward. I'm not given to, I'm not given to fancy. You can just feel it. It's really palpable. Yeah. So that's one way in which I'd like to talk about spiritual rebirth, is an atmosphere between us. And that what we need to do is be open to that atmosphere, to let go into that atmosphere. Sometimes it can be so strong that you don't need to meditate anymore. You just sort of, you just tune into that atmosphere. Do you see how then the arising is us, not me? And that's a much more Buddhist arising. It happens with us. It might be led by a particular person, but they're only channeling it at the moment. Sometimes we'd have these winter retreats at a large winter retreats in the countryside of England. We have a large team, 18 people on the team, sometimes 100 people on the retreat. And, I've led the retreat quite often. I've led the team. Recently I went back to do the shrine. And I'll probably do that again next year. I'm leading it again this year, but next year I think, I'll just go back and do the shrine. And other of my friends stepped forward and then stepped back again. Subhadramati last year was leading the cook's team, working in the kitchen all the time. This year again she's going to be leading it with me. And then she said, the next year I might just go back to cook again. And I was very struck by that. And sitting in a circle together, I thought, this is the ideal of my life. It's not to do with me, it's to do with us. I want a world in which sometimes I step forward to lead, and sometimes I step forward to do the shrine. Sometimes I'm just in the circle, sometimes I step into the circle, sometimes I step back into the circle again. What do you mean? That is the vision of the Dharma, is this shared world. And when that happens, you create a kind of spirit. And even people in that circle pick up on it. Who aren't in that circle pick up on it. One of the things I noticed really strongly on those retreats is how many people say they were inspired by the team. Not by the talks, not by the meditations, not by their own experience, but by seeing the team working together. They feel that exemplifies something which they desperately and deeply need, a sense of a living community. You know what I mean? So what you experience is that those outside the team actually partake of the atmosphere created by the team, if you see what I mean. As if you create something bigger than the sum of its parts, which everyone feels a bit in contact with. This is really our vision for a Buddhist centre, whether it's the Swedish Stockholm Buddhist Centre or the London Buddhist Centre. It's this kind of atmosphere. It only happens when people have a shared vision, which they're committed to, which they're in very deep communication with each other, as much crossover as possible, if possible, living and working together. If not, a lot of crossover with each other. Probably much more than we expect, like a retreat where we've been living together and just crossing over with each other all the time, sharing a world together. If that happens enough in a centre, people pick up on this spirit, which is spiritual rebirth. It's something that transcends the dichotomy between individual consciousness and group consciousness. It's a new kind of consciousness that people pick up on. The second way I wanted to talk analogously about spiritual rebirth is in terms of imagination. So you could say that human beings are made up of greed, hatred and delusion, but that's still not enough, is it? It doesn't do us justice. It's too negative, it's too no-saying. You also would have to say that human beings have greed, hatred, and delusion in bucket loads, I mean like huge forces of our psyche, so much so that when the Buddha gains enlightenment, those forces become universal armies of hatred and aversion, and, you know, daughters of craving, sons of craving, if that worries you. So we've got that in bucket loads, but what we also have is the capacity to imagine. It's just as central to us as, or at least potentially as central to us as our greed, hatred, delusion. We can, human beings have this incredible capacity to imagine. This is our great gift, really, is that we can imagine. We can imagine other states than our own. We can imagine other times than our own. We can imagine into other people, even people who never existed. So you can read Dickens or Thomas Tranströmer, and you can imagine people that they write about but have never existed. So, you know, if you read Dickens deeply, I don't know, a Swedish novelist, I'm afraid, if you read them deeply enough, you live with them, don't you? You actually get to know the characters and actually feel sorry to leave them. They've never existed. But you feel for them, you care for them, you want to know what happens to them next, and you're sometimes slightly heartbroken to leave them behind. And you start to read the book slower and slower as you go towards the end. Incredible human capacity. You know they've been made up, don't you? You know what someone said, but you don't need to worry, then they don't actually exist. You think, I know that. Or, you know, if you were watching Romeo and Juliet, you don't need someone to, as you're starting to weep at the end, you don't need someone to lean over and say, actually, the guy playing Romeo is gay. Or you don't need to say, they're only pretending, they're not really dying. You just say, look, I know that, but you know what you're doing, don't you, in that experience? You know they're just acting, you know it's just pretend. You don't. In some way, the human mind is able to think, I know that, but just let me have this experience. What I'm valuing here is this upwelling, this grey upwelling of imaginative life, that here are these lovers, and they're both crazy and young. I mean, it's a fantastic picture, isn't it, of young love. Both of them are pretty near bonkers. You know, Freud called falling in love the psychosis of ordinary people. And you see that with both of them. They're just completely unable to think clearly because they're just mad in love, you know. And you, part of us just wishes to be like that. And Shakespeare says, tell you what, let's have an evening out. We can really just be like that. We can be young again and in love in that kind of mad way. So you get to experience that incredible purity of love again, and then you get this terrible tragedy and you just want to weep. Yeah? And at the end of it, you come out of this cathartic experience, all the time knowing it's just been made up. And they never existed. But your imaginative experience is what you really value. Yeah? It's an incredible gift, isn't it? So the imagination is what is the practice analogous to spiritual rebirth. All of that world of creativity, all of that imagination is the analogous to spiritual rebirth. Bhante Sangharakshita said if you were to look for a precedent to Buddhism in the West, you're more likely to find it in the arts and the artistic tradition than in the religious history. Yeah. So when Buddhism comes to the West, it's not anything to do with the religious past of the West. Much of that has to be, not all of it, because there's been very incredible positive things about that, but it's probably safer to think of it as being more like the arts. Of course, there are dangers in that as well. So I just want to say a few things about imagination and I'll finish. So imagination has to be clearly distinguished from fancy or fantasy. And this is the difference that Coleridge, the English romantic poet, made between fancy, as he called it, or fantasy, and imagination. So fancy is really is wish fulfillment. or fantasy is sort of wish fulfillment. I mean, that's pornography is the sort of end point of fantasy, because you wish that you looked like that and was having those kind of experiences with people who look like that, if you see what I mean. It's just pure egotism, really. You wish for that. Fancy, in the sense of Coleridge's, Coleridge didn't tend to talk about pornography, did you? You didn't mention things like that, although it did exist at that time. It's always existed. He's talked about fancy, and he said that fancy is really the same old thing in Brand New Drag, which is a quote from Iggy Pop, I believe. It's just the same things of experience, but put together in an arbitrary order. So if you write a poem, you write a poem that involves a zebra, a stick of underarm deodorant, an orange, a syringe, and, I don't know, Stockholm or something. You put all that together, jiggle it all, and you call that imaginative. Do you see what I mean? Actually, all it is just the same old things just jiggled around and poured into a weird-looking mould, which has got imagination written on it. Do you see what I mean? It's very easy that what we call imagination is mostly fancy. It hasn't got any real purchase on the truth. It's just fancy, really. One kind of fancy or another. Genuine imagination is characterized by the unification of thought, emotion, and intuition. Those faculties that in the human being so easily separate become unified into a new quality, a new faculty called imagination. So, for instance, a work of art, a genuine work of art, is as rigorous as a piece of philosophy. Schopenhauer said that he was doing in abstracto what artists were doing in concreto. So he thought that the greatest mind outside of philosophy was Shakespeare, and he thought the greatest mind inside philosophy was Kant. And he said Kant, the difference is that Shakespeare just looked and observed and just said what he saw, whereas Kant created a whole system to say what it was. Yeah? So he said that the arts are doing in concreto, in concrete, directly showing what the arts, what philosophy is telling. Yeah? So any genuine work of art is just as rigorously intellectual as Kant. You can see this even in the metaphors of the Buddha's life. If you unpack them, they are rigorously intellectual. You see what I mean? The metaphors are just as accurate as any kind of highly conceptual formulation. They're showing it rather than telling it. Yeah? And finally, the great symptom of the imagination, when you know that your imagination is in gear, as it were, when you know you've discovered the imagination, and it's something you have to discover, you can't be imaginative, because remember, this is spiritual rebirth, so you can't decide to go off and be imaginative. You, by definition, aren't imaginative. Egotism is just more of the same. It's the same old thing in Brand New Drag, isn't it? Egotism is just more of me. Whether we think we're an artist or not, to the degree to which it's we're trying to be imaginative, it's just more of me. You have to discover the imagination. It has to erupt into work, if you see what I mean, from somewhere else. Yeah. So the great symptom of imagination is when you go beyond yourself. You, in the work of imagination, you travel quite beyond your usual sense of yourself. So much so that you can feel disorientated by it. You don't recognise the terrain you're in suddenly. It's like you get in a train and you turn up and you're in a train you just do not recognise. That is the surefire way of knowing that imagination has been evoked. Usually we can only do it for a tiny bit of time. But it's that sense that what is created or what is thought or what is imagined just goes beyond ourselves a bit. In great works of art, it hugely transcends the individual to a degree which is very, very difficult to imagine, see how it's at all possible. I was thinking of Rilke's sonnets, for instance. I can't remember how many there is, a huge amount. 126, I think, something like that. He wrote them in something like 2 weeks. He'd write one a day, and he said that it was like taking divine dictation, he said. He hardly corrected them at all. They seemed to be his greatest work. He hardly corrected them. He wrote fully out, rhyming sonnets, one after another. Rilke, the German poet. He said it was just like taking divine dictation. So imagination can go beyond you to such a degree that in Western genius, you have arisings that just are impossible. Or think of Bach's cantatas. I think he wrote 256 of them, something like that, huge amount of them. They were performed on a Sunday. He'd write them Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. His poor wife would have to fair copy them. Then they'd have to rehearse them. Then they'd perform the next one on Sunday. And then he'd write another one. You think about half of them are masterpieces. No human being with our ordinary powers could do it. It would kill you, just the sheer amount of writing of music, the sheer amount of setting out, not just for voice but for viola, you'd just kill you. You just couldn't do it. You need to imagine that human beings have this capacity that goes beyond them to be able to do that. There's no real explanation for it otherwise. So that's where I want to finish, with this capacity of imagination to go beyond ourselves. We all have it to some degree, in our meditations, in our puja, even in our attempts to create works of art ourselves. We go beyond ourselves. That is the practice that we can evolve in. You could say the practice for us is puja, but it's also in receptivity to nature, appreciation of art, and so on. So those are the two things I want to draw out from spiritual rebirth. I want to say that spiritual rebirth is much more than saying that it's end of suffering. That doesn't describe the experience, just as it doesn't describe our best experiences. It's quite inadequate to it, so we need a metaphysical, transcendental object to give you a flavour of what the Buddha arising does. The tradition, probably, the most accurate tradition for that is probably the five Buddha mandala. That is how the Buddha is discussed, if you see what I mean, how the Buddha's experience is pictured is by five Buddha mandala and the pantheon and the bodhisattvas. And then I've suggested that the two more practical analogous ways for us to contact that spirit is in a working together in a harmonious community so that something new arises that goes beyond self-consciousness and group consciousness, a new consciousness arises, and that we work to discover our imagination.